ARSC, as I said, has had this long-term commitment to access. As you know, one of our members, Tim Brooks, has recently completed a study with Steve Simoleon that found that 14% of pre-1965 recordings that are documented in discographies, that is those of historical interest to users, are in print now by their rights holders. 14%, that is 86% is not. Our job as ARSC, as I see it, and in the time I've been president under Tim Brooks's fabulous leadership and work, is to avoid the situation that only to the spoilers belong the victors. They have to belong. That's for you, Steve. That one's for you, buddy. I want to talk about, as you know, Tim worked on a resolution and the board approved it. I want to read something from an ARSC resolution. And just a few lines from it, and then I want to introduce Brandy. But it's a drafting of a resolution that ARSC is interested in both legal protection of and fair use of recordings. But it expresses a concern that ARSC, in the current uproar over record piracy, while not without justification, may lead to a shutting off of any possible avenues of duplication and dissemination of sound recordings for bona fide educational and scholarly use. Let me go on. Lack of legislative groundwork in the form of a revised U.S. copyright law defining time limitations of protection and for fair use of sound recording, together with the unwillingness of the record industry thus far to work for national and international codification of these areas, has led to a situation of de facto anarchy in the area of sound recording duplication. The resolution defines ARSC's area of interest in the above field to include, most especially, out-of-print commercial sound recordings, broadcast recordings, film soundtracks, unissued as commercial recordings, live locations. The resolution calls for the consideration of blanket licensing procedures as a means to assuring basic recompense to those owning legitimate interests. That is a compulsory license. This is a resolution sent to the ARSC membership in 1970. I read from an ARSC journal of 1970, before many of you were born. We tried then, or our grandparents tried then, but we didn't make it. But many of us now are more angrier, madder than hell, and we're not going to give up this time. You know, through some things that you've read in the newsletter, I'm going to tell you a little more in the business meeting, that ARSC has hired a lobbyist to work on specific things regarding historical recordings, compensating the owners for them, but assuring that during our lifetimes, maybe some might go into public domain, but because they aren't now, and not going to sort of have somebody 37 years from now read about our efforts, except as sort of a thanks to us. And that's going to depend on the membership, and we'll be talking more about that later. One of the things this study talked about, and this was a very great concern, as I read in their late 60s and early 70s, when ARSC founders were discussing these issues, was the notion of fair use, the use of recordings for scholarship. And this is something that our next speaker does a lot of work in. Here on the campus of Stanford University is the Center for Internet and Society, which was founded, I believe, by Professor Lawrence Lessig, and has a number of residential fellows who are working to study things like the intersection of the internet and technology and content. And one of the residential fellows at the CIS, the Center for Internet Studies, has been helping us. Several have helped ARSC in their efforts with our resolutions to reform copyright. And the one working with Tim Brooks most recently is Brandy Carl, who's with us today. Brandy's work for the Center for Internet and Society is to help litigate fair use cases and also to research issues where law and technology intersect. Brandy is a graduate of MIT and Boston University, has recently come to Stanford as a residential fellow, and has given her time to talk to us today about issues of fair use, sound recordings, and copyright. Brandy, thank you.
Good? Or is it purple? Could be the projector.
We need to load a few more lights.
All right, some technical difficulties that we're not really going to worry about. All right, thanks for having me to here today. I'm really excited to come and talk to you about mostly fair use today, a little bit of copyright, a little bit of preservation, mostly fair use. I'm going to talk about the law and preserving our cultural heritage and recorded sound. It's going to be a little bit of a bleak picture. I think you guys know this already, but broad rights to preserve and archive sound recordings simply don't exist. So a quick copyright background so that we're all on the same page. Copyright is a limited monopoly granted to authors and their creative expression embodied in a tangible medium. It doesn't cover ideas, but it protects expressions of those ideas. So you all know, it includes books and movies and, of course, recorded sound. In the United States, this limited monopoly is granted for the purpose of promoting the progress of the arts and sciences. That is, to encourage the broadening of human understanding, knowledge, and culture by securing for authors limited but exclusive rights in their works. The ability to exclusively exploit an expressive work acts as an incentive for creators to create. Of course, if this limited monopoly is too broad in scope, it can also hamper innovation and learning. One of the legal tools we can use to circumvent this problem is fair use. Fair use is an exception to monopoly control over creative works. It can allow anyone to copy, publish, and distribute parts, and sometimes all, of copyrighted work without permission. And this is what we need in an age of broadened copyright scope. The nature of creative production means that we build on our own past, on our history, to create new creative expression. First of all, what do you think about when you think about sound recordings? You're a diverse group, so you probably all have different ideas about what sound recordings represent to you and to your institutions. The ideas that come to mind might include art, knowledge, politics, and history. But you probably think of them as broadly representing culture, our human activity captured in recorded sound. Perhaps I'm oversimplifying a bit, but this is what the recording industry thinks when they think about sound recordings. The idea of control over a copyrighted work really isn't anything new. It's the same for books, movies, and other copyrighted works. Control over how copyright works are exploited and how they're used. If the works are out of print or otherwise generally inaccessible, control means control over whether the works are experienced at all. And if so, probably in limited form. Control over how you use it, because you're afraid if you use it, you might get hit with a suit for copyright infringement. And this is very much true for a lot of the larger institutions and for many of you smaller collectors that reproduce works and resell your remastered copies. One example of excessive control over copyright might be more familiar to you. Copyright holders preventing the critical fair uses of songs, music, and other audio like minstrel shows with offensive and racist content, but historical import. Excessive control by holders of copyrights may limit the ability of the public to innovate and create, to engage in the free exchange of ideas. Excessive control by holders of copyrights can amount to censorship. Because all of you work with copyrighted material every day, these ideas about control guide what you do every single day. I know you're a sophisticated audience, so I have a 3-minute version of copyright and sound recordings. Various early copyright acts were not universal in their protections. New forms of works enabled by new technologies, yet even the piano role player is a new technology, had to be specifically added to the Copyright Act in order to gain federal copyright protection over those new kinds of works. In addition, before the 76 Copyright Act, state common law, not federal law, protected unpublished works. Before 1972, federal copyright did not extend to sound recordings. With some exceptions, sound recordings of foreign origin, even pre-72 recordings, are protected by federal copyright law. Congress amended the Copyright Act to protect sound recordings made after February 15, 1972. I'm talking about preserving cultural heritage and recorded sound, so I'm kind of focusing on pre-72 recordings, not the later ones. What about the ones that already existed? Copyright and sound recordings made before 72 is an exclusive creature of state law. Protection expires by preemption, by statute, in 2067. That means nearly 60 years from today will pass before pre-72 sound recordings will enter the public domain. It's likely that recordings made over 100 years ago will still be protected by state common law after we're all gone. Of course, many, but not all of these sound recordings are protected by federal copyright in a way. The underlying work, whether it's the musical composition, the play, the dialogue, the poem, whatever might be on there, might be a federally registered work protected by federal law. In many cases, the copyright in these underlying works will expire before the common law copyright in the sound recording. For example, a sound recording published in 1923, the underlying work was registered and renewed properly according to federal law. The copyright in the underlying work will expire in 10 years, in 2018, far before the copyright in the sound recording expires in 2067. For a sound recording published prior to 1923, the underlying work, if any, would be already in the public domain. The only thing preventing full use of the work is the common law copyright. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Naxos, which I think you all have heard of. Capitol Records versus Naxos. Capitol sued Naxos for remastering and reissuing sound recordings made in England, in which the British copyrights had already expired. After the recordings entered the public domain in England, Naxos digitally remastered the performances off of original 1930s shellac recordings and began selling them on CDs in the US. Between the Second Circuit and the New York Court of Appeals, which is New York's Supreme Court, the two decided that the congressional intent to preserve common law copyright in unpublished sound recordings really meant that Congress had intended that state common law also protects published sound recordings. So, New York decided that its common law copyright law protects sound recordings made anywhere in the entire world, even if the copyright protecting the recording has lapsed or expired in another country. In essence, any pre-1972 sound recording made anywhere is protected by copyright in the state of New York. Yeah, it's amazing. So this decision, the Naxos decision, doesn't apply to acts done exclusively outside New York. But given modern commerce and modern ways of doing business and accessing information, the distinction is virtually meaningless. Between internet and mail order and streaming and digital distribution, basically anyone making a use of a pre-1972 sound recording, even if it otherwise would be in the public domain, might be a copyright infringer under New York state law. Now, I don't think this group thinks that Naxos was a bad actor. I think if you go to the Stanford collection, you can listen to the Naxos Music Library even. And they've done a lot of great restoration. But you know, whether they're an infringer, a bad actor, or a hero, they lost this case, but we also lost the case. We're prevented from accessing our own cultural heritage at the recording industry's will. So that's the state of the law right now. And I'm going to talk a little bit about preservation. Sound recordings, those are purple wax cylinders. Sorry about the purple. But even relatively modern ones suffer from being fixed and fragile and obsolete media. Every use deteriorates the medium that contains the recording. This is not news. It's true of cylinders, 78s and 45s, 8-tracks, cassette tapes, wire. You got it, you name it. They disintegrate and they warp and they scratch and they break. Even digital media has its own shortcomings. I'm not gonna talk about that. It's a little bit outside the scope and I think you're gonna talk about it later today. But for the most part, the listening public doesn't have access to sound recordings originally embodied in fragile media. Even if they did, they don't have the tools and equipment to listen to these antique recordings. And some of you don't even have the tools and equipment to listen to all the recordings in your collection again. So the question is, can we legally preserve this? There are really two separate basic legal issues in preservation: avoiding liability under federal law and avoiding liability under state law. The basic problem common to both is that by preserving the sound recording, by transferring it to a new medium, you have to make a copy. And if that copy is digital, Usually accessing the copy entails the creation of a new copy. So by allowing access to digitally preserved works, preservationists could engage in massive copyright infringement. For the most part, the recording industry doesn't care. They're not interested in reissuing recordings that no longer have significant or even moderate commercial value. In large part, a great deal of very early recordings have literally no commercial value. However, sometimes preservationists, especially those that are more of a commercial nature, find out the hard way that record companies do indeed sometimes care. The Naxos case involved a commercial defendant. So what about libraries? Well, you guys know that there's no broad carve-out to allow preservation by anyone. Even preservation by nonprofit libraries and archives for scholarly and research purposes. There are some narrow exceptions, of course, and you guys probably know them better than I do. You can preserve sound recordings, but you can make three copies. You have to have the work in your own collection, and digital copies can't be made available outside the premises. These are rules that, again, you're more familiar with than I am, and they're very limited. They don't allow broad public access to the recordings in your own collections. And remember, these rules only apply to the federally protected underlying works, not to the common law copyright, the state laws that protect the common law copyright. It's a mishmash, and it differs state by state. The state laws usually prohibit piracy or unfair competition. They're not usually statutory. California's happens to be. In California, there's a limited exemption for nonprofit educational institutions. The complex statutory hurdles making it expensive and messy for exempt institutions to engage in legal preservation. So one of the questions I have is, should it be only libraries that engage in kind of large-scale preservation? Libraries might have more resources and legal loopholes available to them, but I'm not sure that there's any really great reasons to disallow private entities and collectors from preserving sound recordings that they own copies of. I'm talking in a preservation sense, not a legal sense right now. But the statutory framework in which libraries work to preserve sound recordings also prevents them from widely distributing the works as two drawbacks. The first is that the work isn't widely disseminated, leaving the public without access to the work. The second is that the works aren't disseminating, leaving a gap in preservation, because the best way to ensure lasting access is to make lots and lots of copies. So we know for sure that sound recordings will be in the public domain in 2067, unless the law changes. That's good news, even though it's a long time from now. It's bad news, because it's a long time from now. We'll be able to access our history and sound recordings from the late 19th century onwards, starting in 2067. So that's where my little SOS comes in. It's a little corny, but I want to make the point, if we wait to legally preserve these sounds according to our current legal regime, we may be in trouble. If we don't do something now, it might be too late in 2067, because sound recordings are fixed in fragile media. Some of the audio could become irretrievable if it isn't preserved now. Besides, who wants to wait until 2067 when we'll all be dead? So that's kind of my depressing picture. And the question is, what's the good news? Well, the good news is that we don't know how much is out there, and some experts think it's a lot. Some think it's around 90% of historical recordings exist in some form. That's pretty awesome. That's a lot of historical recordings. So what do we do with that? A lot of these sound recordings are in archive and library collections, but many are in the collections of private individual collectors. Very few of them have been reissued by the rights holders, despite demand from scholars and collectors and aficionados of recorded sound and plain old regular people. So, should we wait until 2067? Should we wait until your descendants or your institutions can use them without restrictions in 2067? Or can we use them now and learn from them now? Many of you are doing this privately. You engage in a lot of uses of these historical recordings, but I'm always pushing for more, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So what we want, and what can we do? What we want is the ability to use our own cultural history. I'm going to suggest what we want are two things. The ability to make fair uses of pre-1972 sound recordings, and the ability to easily preserve pre-1972 sound recordings and make them accessible to the public. So fair use. We know that it doesn't make sense that we can't do or don't know what we can do under New York law and other state laws, what we can under federal law. We don't have clear legal authority stating that state common law copyright is curtailed by the First Amendment, allowing even core fair uses like commentary, analysis, and criticism, along with some quotations. In New York, a claim for common law copyright infringement has just two elements: the existence of a valid copyright and an unauthorized reproduction of the work protected by that copyright. We're not really sure about exceptions to common law infringement in New York. We know that commercial benefit to the defendant or marketplace competition by the copyright owner are not essential to making out a valid claim.